This is Morgan Beatty speaking. I'll be back in a moment with news of the day.
If you're a registered nurse, you can serve humanity in no better way than as an Army nurse. Army nurses care for our brave soldiers who have been wounded in action. They help these soldiers in another fight, the sometimes long and difficult fight to regain health. After only 4 weeks of basic military training, Army nurses are commissioned as second lieutenants and are directly assigned to duty. They receive an initial allowance of $250 for uniforms and equipment. If you're a registered nurse and under 45, you will qualify. Call at your nearest Red Cross chapter or write to Surgeon General, U.S. Army, Washington, D.C. Remember, the Army needs you urgently. And now from Washington, here is Morgan Beatty.
Our broadcast today originates in the NBC Navy studio in Washington. The news is better today from the Western Front, much better. American forces fighting up from the south, General George Patton's Third Army, have made their way to Bastogne and rescued the American troops holding on there in Belgium, holding on for 10 days by the skin of their teeth. And Bastogne, we must remember, is the best base for the entire German salient westward. Thus, the whole German flank, the underbelly of their new front, is sagging. As a result, Marshal von Rundstedt has pulled his horns in almost everywhere on the front except to the northwest. His armor is drawing back toward the center of the bulge. But frontline reports warn us, and so does Secretary Stimson of the War Department, warn us against making too much of the low. There is, of course, the possibility that von Rundstedt believes General Eisenhower has massed strength and will try to smash the whole German offensive force in the bulge. And he may be drawing back so he can make a run for it, retreat across the German border, and save his valuable armor. That is one possibility, but there's another, and it's this, that von Rundstedt is drawing back to reform his lines and lash out again with renewed fury, the fury of desperation, and that's just as strong a possibility as retreat. It seems to me that Secretary Stimson tells the story well today in his regular press radio interview. He says, and we quote, "Our troops on the southern flank have smashed forward to relieve our units and circled in Bastogne. That narrows the German-controlled corridor to 20 miles. Elsewhere," he adds, "the Germans have not been able to punch forward. It's too early to predict what additional power the enemy may be able to muster, but it is evident that our forces are beginning to hit back with increasing effectiveness." The Secretary thus warns us not to take anything for granted, but he preceded his war review today with a significant statement, confirming, incidentally, our report to you some days ago, that the Germans, when they lashed out, had in mind the apparent weakening of the links of unity between the Allies, Russia, Great Britain, and the United States. "Since we entered the war," says Mr. Stimson, "the enemy has exerted all his cleverness of propaganda to effect a cleavage in the British-American front of a free press, and he's been particularly vicious and ingenious in his efforts to effect a division between the Russians and ourselves in the coordination of our military enterprises. The Germans are using their present offensive to further this effort," he adds, "and it is most important to avoid falling into their trap. The attitude of our press and radio commentators," says the Secretary, "and reporters, has been rather remarkable for restraint and freedom from yielding to the temptation to make violent criticism following any reverse. The continued confidence displayed in the Allied arms and command is most reassuring." The Secretary of War spoke at a moment when the United States and Great Britain were asking Russia to explain in detail the removal of equipment from the Romanian oil fields to the Soviet Union. No criticism is implied, but our political representatives in Bucharest apparently are restricted by the Russian army in their inquiries. There is much American and British equipment in the Romanian field, you know. At the same time, Prime Minister Winston Churchill found it necessary to remain in Athens under fire to supervise the handling of Allied troubles there. And the Army newspaper Stars and Stripes in London today took note of the affairs of the Allies by urging Britain, Russia, and the United States to close ranks. "Unity and solidarity," says the newspaper, "were strong when the United Nations were militarily weak and the war was in a bad way. Well," adds the Army editor, "the bugles of battle are heard again above the bickering. For the love of holy God," the editor pleads, "let's listen to the dead. Let's learn from the living. Let's join ranks again against the foe and toward the future." And here at home, the president felt it necessary once again to take over Montgomery Ward establishment, this time in 7 cities. The Army's in charge because the company has failed to obey directives of the War Labor Board. It's not that Ward is a direct war industry so much, but that strikes and disorders, in the president's view, have a tendency to spread. "Strikes in wartime," he said, "cannot be condoned, whether they are strikes by workers against employers or strikes by employers against their government. All of our energies," he added, "are engrossed in fighting a war on the military battlefronts. We have none to spare for fighting a war on the industrial battlefronts." It seems clear that nothing is gained by not facing the hard-to-face facts in the present war situation. Nothing at all. Neither should we hide facts that are more significant for the future, facts that are actually inspiring to any American. When Secretary of War Stimson paid his compliments to the press and radio this morning, it seems to me he was really praising the people of this country, who themselves have been restrained and calm during the reversal in the West. They seem like the men on the battlefronts to understand a lot more than they might be expected to understand, and to tolerate a great deal more than people in a democracy might be expected to tolerate. They understand above all else that a great page in a great historic moment is being written by their sons and brothers and sweethearts on a swaying battlefront, regardless of the mistakes that may or may not have been made. And the men who are doing the fighting understand, too, what their performance in the last 10 days and in the days ahead of them can mean to this nation in the future. It took no less a war correspondent than Ed Ball today to write the record of the human side of the siege of Bastogne in Belgium, to tell how heroic Americans held out until relief came. The record has none of the highlights you'd expect in a movie scenario. One private soldier told correspondent Ball that the battle was like this. "We were shooting like hell all the time," he said, "and the Germans were paying it back with interest. Look at the map and you can see why," this private explained. "It's the hub of 7 highways and 1 railroad is Bastogne, and they had to have the town if they were to keep on going." Then Ball tells more of the stories. The German commander finally thought he had the American garrison where he wanted it, and he sent in an ultimatum. It took the reply of the American commander only 30 minutes to reach the enemy. Here it is. To the German commander it said, "Nuts. The bravery of our men under terrible conditions is almost breathtaking. One surrounded unit in Bastogne even managed to publish a daily newspaper on a mimeograph machine. All through the siege, the Christmas edition carried a brave Merry Christmas at the masthead. And this editorial, it says, 'What's merry about all this, you ask? We're fighting, it's cold, we aren't home.' All true, but what have we accomplished? We've stopped cold everything that has been thrown at us from the north, the east, the south, and the west." And now your announcer. I'll be back in exactly 60 seconds.
A seaman has said, "Few people realize how long and drawn out spare time is at sea. A seaman can't go down to the corner for a soda or a glass of beer. He can't go to the movies after work. Our merchant seamen need some sort of relaxation and relief from torpedo tension and convoy fatigue. And an interesting book is the ideal answer to this problem. Now, the job of furnishing seagoing libraries to American merchant ships is handled by the American Marine Library Association, but right now, at least 100,000 books are needed. Our merchant seamen want all kinds of books: novels, westerns, biographies, books on science, psychology, poetry, humor, in fact, on any subject. Now, if you have any books that you can give, wrap them, label packages books, and address them to Merchant Marine Library, New York 6, New York. Or if west of the Mississippi, Merchant Marine Library, San Francisco 11, California. See if you have some books you can send. Now, once again, Morgan Beatty.
No doubt you've heard by now that today is an anniversary, the third anniversary of the Naval Construction Battalions, the Seabees, the men who make the forward bases and airstrips for Allied offensives on both sides of the world. There are 234,000 of these men, three quarters of them overseas. Actually, they're men from the building trades in the United States in uniform. The Navy has capitalized on their skill. They work with many of the same tools they knew on construction jobs in New York, St. Louis, and Peoria. Cranes, diesel shovels, and, in addition, pontoon units are their tools. But on the third CB anniversary, we're fortunate to have as our guest Commodore William Mac Angus of the Civil Engineer Corps, United States Navy, of Jacksonville, Florida. He is now officer in charge, 3rd Naval Construction Brigade, in the service force of the 7th Fleet. That may not mean much to you, but to a naval man, it means Commodore Angus is the man in charge of the Seabees on Leyte Island in the Philippines. He's back for a few days on important business, and the next time you hear about him, he'll be somewhere in the Pacific again. But what we want to know now is what the Seabees are doing on Leyte. Commodore, can you tell us something about them?
Yes, Mr. Beatty. One of the things the Seabees were doing when I left a few weeks ago was building an airstrip so our planes could strike the enemy from the air as soon as possible. And if I interpret what I hear on the air and read in the papers, the Army and Navy Air Forces are now using that strip for the purpose intended.
But what do the Seabees have to do to build an airstrip, sir?
First, they must build their way ashore, Mr. Beatty. That is, put up portable ramps and wharves so their cranes, bulldozers, trucks, and all the heavy equipment necessary for road building can move in under its own power. When they are assigned to build an airstrip, as they were at Leyte, they go ashore soon after the first wave. Then the CBs must select an area on which the strip can be built without too much cutting and filling, and they must find a deposit of rock, usually coral, for surfacing or paving. The next step is to build a smooth pavement 100 feet wide by a mile or so long. That's equivalent to a first-class highway 5 miles long. And they must do this in whatever weather comes their way, or under bombardment and enemy sniper fire if they should get that too. They must work in shifts, 24 hours a day until the assignment is completed.
They must have had a tough time of it at Leyte.
They certainly did. They worked in rainfall we never see in this country. It fell in sheets for days on end, as much as the average American city gets in a whole year. The Japs made it tough from the air, too. They bombed us as frequently as they could. The men don't mind it so much when they know what the target is, but when the bombs start falling through the overcast, when the enemy doesn't know exactly what he's hitting, the missiles are labeled to whom it may concern, you might say. It's harder to work then than it is when you can see them and know they're trying to hit you.
I can imagine it, but the rain, how do they work in the rain?
They just keep on going. At Leyte, some of the equipment bogged down in the mud a few times, but even with all the handicaps, the airstrip was ready for fighter planes in less than a month from the time we started work. And there's one good thing about rainy weather. You don't have to sprinkle the strip as you roll it.
I see, but when the CBs have to build an advanced base, a naval base, what kind of a job is that?
That's more complicated. They go into the beach later. They build temporary docks and wharves out of pontoon cells, floating empty steel boxes 5 by 5 by 7 feet. These are later replaced by regular timber piers. The CBs have to take ashore the material for all kinds of buildings and supply. They build ship repair units, units that repair warships so they can either rejoin the fleet or go back to a major base for permanent repair. They build shops, floating dry docks, a supply base. They erect receiving barracks to house the men ordered to or from ships operating in the area. They put up a hospital and a tank farm, that is, oil storage facilities. This collection of buildings and units, of course, has its own road system, electric power plant and distribution system, telephone system, fire department, and a filtered water supply.
Remarkable. In short, they build a miniature Pearl Harbor nearly everywhere they go.
Practically speaking, that's it. Navies must have naval bases, forward bases, or they cannot operate efficiently.
That means the CBs must be resourceful.
Yes, I've seen some amazing examples of their resourcefulness, examples we cannot say anything about. But there are some examples of CB ingenuity that can be cited. It's essential that the men wear clean clothing in the tropics. It has been shown that the oftener they change, the less likely they are to contract skin diseases out there. So CBs build washing machines to supplement those with which the battalions are equipped. I've seen them made of all kinds of things and operated with all kinds of power, including windmills. And as you know, the first days ashore are always difficult. As he moves forward, it's the rule that a man takes what he needs, anything he can get his hands on. The CBs have lost lots of cigarettes, tools, and choice bits of food that way. So they've taken to cutting holes in pontoons and putting their prized valuables inside. Then they weld the top back on. It makes an ideal strong box until they can find a better one.
Commodore, we thank you for this intimate glimpse of the CBs, and we think the Navy ought to be congratulated for using this great pool of American skill. We know the CBs will be in there fighting to the last. And that's all for now, and thank you. I'll be back at this same time tomorrow.
When you look at the staggering lists of our casualties, don't you often wonder how they're all cared for so that each and every one is given the best fighting chance for recovery? Well, the gallant nurses and doctors in service are doing their utmost, and so far, they've been more than holding their own. But as the casualties increase, so must the medical personnel. Right now, there's an urgent demand for more Army nurses. At least 10,000 nurses are needed, and the very lives of some of our servicemen will depend upon the Army's getting those nurses. If you're a registered nurse, won't you answer your country's call and enlist in the Army? Visit your nearest Red Cross chapter today. Time means lives. Morgan Beatty is heard Monday through Friday. Tomorrow at this time, keep up with the news with Morgan Beatty. This is the National Broadcasting Company.